Today, I'm going to introduce you to Raj Vedapta. He's the CEO and co-founder of BloomReach. And I am really thrilled to have Raj here because I met Raj some years ago and I was fascinated by what he was doing. And I'm also looking forward to catching up with you, Raj, on where things are today and how things have been going for the last few years that we haven't talked. So welcome. Is Raj's audio video working?
I think so. Can you hear me okay?
Yes. What about your video? There we go. Perfect. Okay. We have the video on. So Raj, tell us about BloomReach. I know it's a fascinating technology and I've always been quite excited about what you're doing. So let us share with our audience about BloomReach.
Sure. Well, thanks for having me on the show, Sarvana. It's a pleasure to be here after a couple of years after we launched publicly. And, you know, the vision of the company and the mission of the company have really remained intact over the last several years. And the intention was always to create a personalized web, to create a digital experience on sites and apps that enabled every time you were going online, whether it was for shopping purposes or whether it was to look for a movie or look for a vacation destination, that the website you'd see, the experience you would see, would be exactly on point with what you were looking for as a consumer and exactly on point with what that marketer or enterprise was looking to offer you on behalf of their business. And, you know, so often when we started the company, we felt like the most websites were still very static. What you saw was the same thing as what I was, as the other thousands and thousands of visitors to that website or app. And how could we make that a whole lot more dynamic, a whole lot more personalized, a whole lot more relevant? And so we built a platform that today we call the BloomReach Personalization Platform. And you can take any website or app, plug into, and it's going to return the perfect web page or the perfect app experience. And that's going to result in you finding what you're looking for and the business delivering what. So the proposition is actually quite simple. But the technology underneath the covers has always been, you know, quite complex, and you know, I think we're still early innings in delivering on that vision.
And what kind of customers have you seen the maximum traction with and the maximum impact in personalizing their user experiences?
So it's been our initial target market has very much been in the e-commerce space. So today we work with some of the largest e-commerce companies in the U.S., about 170 brands. Many of which are in the top 500 retailers, brands, B2B commerce businesses, mm-hmm. Williams-Sonoma and people like Neiman Marcus and large retailers that often have a high level of diversity of content, products, and services. So the problem of what the perfect breadth is or page is or content is exactly to you out there on the web shopping has been the use case that we targeted initially and has been a very successful initial market for us.
And you are an enterprise software company, yes?
That's right. We're a SaaS company.
Enterprise SaaS company. So when you first came to see me, I think it was back in 2012, I went back and checked when we did your first story. You had just come out of stealth, raised your first round of financing, I think it was a Series A, and you had announced your product. But you already had a lot of enterprise customers and significant revenue. If I recall, you were already over $5 million in revenues. And how did you get to that level of validation and traction in a bootstrap mode? And what can our entrepreneurs learn from you?
Yeah, I think several things. It started, I think, with a clear identification of the problem. You know, in my view, you know, it's very important to have an ambitious long-term vision, but it's very important to have a very practical and incremental execution plan when you're small and have very few resources. And so we were very focused. I think, you know, the initial problem area we identified was for e-commerce, and within e-commerce, how could we build content dynamically using machine learning that would have the effect of increasing the amount of acquisition of new visitors for those websites. So in the early days of the company's life, it was myself, my co-founder, Ashu, a small team of engineers. There were five or six of us, and you know, we would just call people within our target market and literally say, "Hey, we have this amazing technology that can personalize your digital experience. If it works, it's going to massively increase your customer acquisition. If it doesn't work, well, you know, you've tried something that is highly innovative and probably has the opportunity to give you competitive differentiation in the market. And what I can promise you is that we have the best team of technologists that will be working with you to make it successful, and we'll be willing to do whatever it takes to make that happen. And if you're willing to innovate with us, we'd love to work with you. So we're quite straightforward with our prospects about the early risks on the technology, and just being transparent with them in some ways I think endeared us to them. And after a lot of conversations, we probably pitched 100 people, we got our first one or two people who would be willing to work with us. And we iterated with them, and just as we predicted, it actually did not work initially. And then we went through the process of fine-tuning it, improving it, iterating with them, and ultimately we got our first one or two clients, and everything took off from there.
How long does it take you to actually show results in your technology?
So these days, you know, it takes 6 to 8 weeks, typically, is the pilot period we will run. Even today, you know, though we have 250 people and hundreds of clients, we go in and offer a pilot in which we'll go in and say, hey, connect to our APIs, and we'll power your experience, and we'll show you the incremental acquisition benefit or conversion benefit or revenue benefit that results from the technology, and we'll be able to demonstrate that to you in the pilot. And so that initial thinking from the very early days back in 2009 and 2010, where we would prove the value early on, has remained a core part of the go-to-market plan for the company.
And that was true, the 6 to 8 week to showing metrics and ROI was true in the beginning as well?
That was true in the beginning as well. It's actually probably compressed to where it is, you know, it can be done in much shorter time periods today. But we felt at that time, absolutely, it was 6 to 8 weeks, and it was highly variable, frankly, I mean, because it was not a proven technology at that point. There was a great deal of R&D risk in the company in its early days, and so there was a lot of variability to that early on. But when it worked, it had such a profound impact on the revenue of our client that people were willing to be patient to see it work out. And that was maybe another lesson that I had in those early days was to really make sure that the business impact on our clients was significant enough that it was worth working with a startup.
Right, right. And you were working with very, very sophisticated technology. So how did you bring this team together? And in a period where you did not raise financing, how did you sustain that team for that long a period?
Right. Well, you know, I mean, you know, we picked a problem area that most people at that time said, you know, the idea of using machine learning to power very varied digital experiences, everything from businesses that are selling books to electronics to clothing to content or whatever it might be. And so when we went to the initial, you know, initially when we thought about it, we said there's really a very small group of people with expertise in machine learning and search and relevance and personalization that we need to recruit. And many of them Google and Facebook and large companies at that time. And so we would go to them and we'd say, hey, this is an unsolved technical problem that if solved would go a long way towards just improving the quality of the experience on the internet. You know, and I think the almost the difficulty of the problem was a motivator for the right set of people. Mm-hmm. It was a challenge that they were willing to take on because it seemed worth it. And so by making it such a daunting challenge, we were able to get the initial set of people together. And it was really only a team of 5 or 6 people, but it was the right 5 or 6 people. And then we gave them a long window of time to iterate and fail and try and improve, and that enabled us to ultimately get there. And that, in turn, gave us barriers to entry downstream.
And these people all work for Equity?
These people all work for Equity. You know, we did have some support at some point from, you know, seed and Series A investors, but in the early days, very much it was about Equity, and it was about. Fortunately, I had been in startups before, and I had started companies before, so I had enough credibility with them and with the fundraising market to have some credibility in future possibilities of raising financing, which all came to be true, you know, downstream.
Did you put some of your own money?
Put some of my own money, put a great deal of time. Certainly was not, you know, I wasn't, you know, I had a family, I had a daughter, I lived in California. It was by no means a low burn environment to be. And you know, and I think that just shows that it's all possible. It's, you know, there's no right time or there's no right circumstance within which to do it.
So what you've done, this bootstrap first, raise money later philosophy, it's a mantra for 1M by 1M. We kind of use this as our, you know, key blueprint, so to speak.
Right.
We have case study after case study on this particular method. You seem to have followed that principle to a T. What in your view are the advantages, and what are there any disadvantages?
You know, I think I'm probably, there are businesses that I know today that have been bootstrapped all the way, and there are businesses mm-hmm. that were completely, you know, financed all the way. And we were exactly in the middle, I would say, you know, in the sense that we were bootstrapped in the early days, but then at some point the opportunity became large enough that we went out and raised financing and built the business. And I think for us that was the right balance. In the early days, it's typically the case that money is not your real barrier. If money is your barrier, then the nature of the problem that you're going to pick is probably not the right problem anyway, because it's very rare that the competitive advantage startup is the amount of capital that it has. It's typically the idea, the proposition, the technology, other set of factors. And so if that's true, then in some sense bootstrapping, you know, or just being very cash efficient in the early days is actually a very effective focusing function. It requires you to really identify what the core essence of the business is and get that right. And that core essence serves you well downstream with or without money. And so I think there's a lot of advantages in the early days to not throwing a lot of money at a problem. It really requires you to raise the bar of your idea, your execution, your team, your proposition, your selling skills, your really across the board. And that very much proved true to us. So the way we looked at it was we need to prove it out in a fairly bootstrapping, you know, very low burn kind of manner. But then once we proved it out, then to really build it out and scale it out, money was valuable. It could really be an accelerator to achieve that vision.
And are there any disadvantages to this methodology, do you think?
I think the disadvantages are it probably limits the type of opportunities one can go after, in the sense that if you were going out and saying, okay, you know, I'm going to build a rocket that's going to go to the moon, it's pretty hard to undertake those kinds of propositions in this manner. So it eliminates a set of opportunities that may be, you know, more difficult to undertake, but you know that still leaves a lot. So I'm not sure there's huge disadvantages. Certainly, it also creates circumstances where certain groups of people, under economic circumstances, where they absolutely can't do it, you know, can't do it. But once again, I find that those are the minority.
So what has happened in the last 4 years? Key milestones, key achievements, metrics. I know you've grown very well. So talk about the journey of the growth journey, the market adoption, et cetera.
The journey has been terrific. I think we did wait even after we raised, before we publicly launched the company, because we wanted to really have substance and not just hype. And so we did have substance in 2012 when we launched publicly, and then today, you know, as we get into 2016, the company is very much a leader in this personalization software marketing, it's being called marketing SaaS kind of space. And we've got about 200 people. We have subsequently raised a fair amount of capital, actually. So just last week, we announced a $56 million capital raise. Capital.
What is the total amount of capital that you've raised now?
We have raised about $98 million in the business. We have about 170 brands. We are on a path where, from a revenue perspective, you know, I think we have the growth rates and the unit economics and the metrics to suggest that, you know, the key metrics of a public offering are possible and within reach. And so,
in what time frame?
You know, the time frame is hard to know. The certainly the metrics would support being there within 2 years. The decision about whether to do it or not, I think, is independent.
Sure.
But the metrics would support having the scale and the unit economics to where it could be a publicly traded software company if it chooses to be, you know, within that time frame.
And what are some of the, you know, strategic highlights of how you have shepherded your way through this growth?
Yeah, so I almost would think of us as having gone through, you know, almost three phases of the company's evolution. In 2009, it was an R&D problem. It was a small team. It was proving out the technology. From 2010 to 2012, we picked one market, which was e-commerce. We picked one problem area, which was customer acquisition. We picked one geography, which was the U.S. We picked one market segment, which was the enterprise segment. And we said, let's win there. And so from 2010 to 2012, we were very focused on that single application, and the business skyrocketed because we were very focused. Around 2012, we then said, okay, we have some credibility. We have been successful in that market segment. Let's get back to the original vision of personalizing the entire digital experience, and let's broaden the proposition into multiple products. And so we made yet another controversial decision, which was not just to scale purely through sales and marketing, but to double down on innovation and product development. And we doubled our investment, and from 2012 to now, you know, we have very much been building out multiple applications towards a single platform, with the idea that there's many different digital experiences. People are sometimes on email, on a mobile device, you know, on landing pages, on the search box, and we want all of it to be personalized. We want that entire platform to come from reach. And so we have really gotten into multi-product development, and then ultimately into the validation of those products with our customers and the selling of those products much more broadly. So that's been very much, you know, the third phase, I would say, is scaling through products. And so here we are today, and you know, I think that puts us in a position where we have a platform opportunity in addition to just a single application SaaS opportunity.
And do you have customers who are buying the entire portfolio, the entire platform? Yes?
We have a lot of start with one, adopt multiple of them, or buy the whole platform from the get-go. And so it's been a very effective strategy in the sense that selling more to the same set of people and being more valuable to the same set of people improves sales and marketing metrics. It endears you to your clients. It deepens customer relationships. It improves the average deal size that you have, and it has a cascading effect on all of the economics of the business.
Now, what about sales? Is this something that you're selling all direct through your own sales force? Do you partner with the system integrators? What has been your strategy?
So we sell it direct, and we have a go-to-market team at this point that is about 40 people. So there's a substantial investment in direct selling, and it is large enterprise selling, and so it requires that kind of sales force. But in the meantime, we have also developed a series of partnerships with systems integrators. We announced a significant partnership with IBM. We announced a partnership with Demandware and SAP. So we have had some partnerships, but I would say they have been complementary to the primary go-to-market of the company, which has been going direct. And it was an important choice as well. You know, either you're sort of high price point and going direct, or you're very, you know, low touch and self-serve proposition or a channel proposition. In our case, it was the former.
But it also sounds like the kind of product you're building, the level of personalization, the level of continuous R&D is actually, it's beneficial to have direct customer relationships, because you achieve a lot higher customer intimacy in that process, and just the channel between the customer feedback and the product team is much faster.
Right. It is helpful to have those kinds of intimate customer relationships. And in many cases, you know, our customers, we take on a lot with them. Our billions of dollars of transactions, you know, for them. And at this point, 20% of e-commerce revenue in the U.S. at some point goes through a page that's powered by Bloomreach. And so you can imagine that the degree of testing and validation that a customer that's processing billions of dollars of revenue for their business is going to demand from a partner is quite high, and so it's important that we retain that customer intimacy and build the supporting functions as well that enable that kind of environment.
And what about pricing? So if that percent, 20% of, almost 20% of e-commerce revenue is going through Bloomreach, do you actually get a percentage of that?
No, in effect we do. We don't price by taking a total percentage of the total, but you know, a lot of our proposition, because we will run pilots and proofs of concept, is to demonstrate the ROI. So if there's a $1 billion company and we can have a 20% top line impact or a 10% top line impact, $200 million of top-line impact on a business. And so they're, if you're able to demonstrate that, they are willing to pay for that, you know, and they're willing to share in some of those economics. And we try to make it so that we don't overcomplicate the pricing. At the same time, you know, it is the kind of proposition that is high value, and it is not inexpensive.
So what is it anchored on? What is your pricing anchored on?
It's typically tiered by some metric. And so we have several applications now. Some of those applications are tiered by page views on the website. Some are tiered by revenue on the website. Some are tiered by usage or API calls. So it just depends. Now we have several applications that are priced consistent with the way the buyer buys. But all of them are SaaS pricing models that have long-term contracts and predictable revenue streams associated with them.
Oh, interesting. Okay. Now, you just raised a round of financing. We're probably seeing kind of like the tail end of unicorn mania, but the unicorn mania still exists. There are, I think, about 246 unicorns in the market right now. Are you one of them? And what do you think of this unicorn mania?
I just don't think it's relevant, you know, from the perspective of an entrepreneur. I mean, it's purely about, it's purely about hyping up a series of companies. I've never really spent a lot of time worried about that, thinking about that, focused on that, or anything of that kind. I think we have a couple of basic principles. First and foremost, achieve the product vision and achieve the customer vision. And then on the financial side, just be a responsible steward of capital and people and ideas, you know, along the way. And so we have never gotten caught up in valuation levels that are massively in excess of the reality of the company. I believe that at the end of the day, the responsibility of a founder in their heart of hearts is to raise money at a valuation they believe they deserve, and they can look deeply into their heart and determine if they deserve that valuation. Because at the end of the day, the rubber meets the road and you have to deliver. You know, and so what is the point of raising money at insane prices and all the press that comes along with that and having a big party, and then 2 or 3 years down the road facing the reality of down rounds and layoffs and bad investments and all of those consequences, you know, occur. And because this is the third time I've been down this road, and I was around in 2001 and I saw what happened and I've been through that road, I have been much more careful about making sure that we raise capital effectively at the right price. We've had steady up rounds all throughout. We've created value for our employees, our shareholders, our customers, and ourselves every step of the journey, methodically and systematically. And I think that's been the right way to go. So I'm not worried about the unicorns. I agree. I think the recent fundraising process, you know, it's more than tail end. I would say that for the really later stage companies, as we are a growth stage company, the markets are all but shut down for those unicorn companies that don't deserve those valuations.
Yeah, the thing that's very unhealthy that has been going around is a lot of entrepreneurs kind of have caught up in this mania, and they think that, you know, to hire you need to be a unicorn, to get any publicity you need to be a unicorn, you need to be in this unicorn club lists that come out and so forth. And I don't know if you've read any of the coverage that we have been doing.
Yes.
We kind of, you know, lay things bare. You know, if you don't have the metrics, if you have a unicorn valuation, fine, but you're going towards the unicorp, so to speak.
It actually is worse, you know, because, yeah, you have the moment of joy, but, you know, I totally agree with your writing on this topic. It winds up hurting you downstream because you have sold employees a bill of goods. You have sold your customers, your investors, all of those things. It doesn't come to pass. And then you're dealing with much more dire consequences downstream. And actually, the investors will always protect themselves because they have all the structure in those rounds to do so. The key management team, you know, members will ultimately get protected because the investors need them, and the people that will get screwed are the employees, and that's just right.
Actually, from an employee's point of view, if you're kind of thinking of joining a startup that touts itself to be a unicorn, you should be very, very careful, because that may not be the best path for your career from a financial point of view. It may look very good on your resume that you worked for a unicorn company for 3 years or whatever, but that may not, you may end up making only your salary and nothing, no upside at all if you get caught up in an imploding unicorn situation. Absolutely.
No, and one of the things we try to do a lot is be very transparent about, so you know, as you point out, it can be hard to hire and be honest about these things, and hard to be honest about these things. So we've tried to be very transparent about explaining this to, you know, both within our hiring process as well as within our existing employee base, so that people understand this very clearly, and I think that helps. Ultimately, you know, most folks who work in the technology industry in some form, you know, are totally capable of understanding.
Yeah. They're very smart people. There's nothing not to understand. It's just they don't know what questions to ask.
Right.
And there are a certain set of questions that you should ask in this kind of a negotiation to make sure that you are joining the right opportunity. There's an opportunity cost to your career. Russ, thank you very much for coming. I know you have to run. We have 4 entrepreneurs today who are going to be presenting. I hope everybody enjoyed. Is there anybody who wants to ask a quick question of Raj before he takes off? You can ask in public chat, but we really have 2 minutes before we have to switch to the presenters. Very quickly, folks. Pooja Bindu Madhav is asking, Raj, why is it hard to hire? What do you look for while hiring?
Number one, we look for consistency with our culture, which we're very passionate about and we write a lot about and talk a lot about. We certainly look for all the, depending on the job function, if it's a technical job function, we'll make sure that they're the top set of folks in their field and can cope with the environment and the problem space that we're looking for. We'll certainly look for all of the other intangibles that make somebody a great Bloom Reacher. And it is hard to hire, but it is very possible. And then the other thing that I've learned about hiring is about staying in your lane, in the sense that you may not be the right person for all the amazing people in the world. You are the right person for the very specific set of people for whom you are a good. Staying in your lane means that you can, and we have been a great brand in the big data space and the data science space, and so we have recruited some of the best people in the world, you know, in that space, and they ultimately themselves recruit other great people in that space. People recruit people. And so that's been what's most effective for us from a hiring perspective.
Raj, one last question from Gauri Das, who's asking, in the early stages, do your product vision get impacted by your seed or venture funders?
You know, I think they do if you choose the wrong partners, which is very possible. You have to remember that the selection of your investors is a marriage, you know, for the long term, so choose wisely. And it's very important that they have
a marriage without a divorce possibility.
A marriage without a divorce possibility. And what I really believe about investors is that there's some upside in choosing the right investors, but there's a lot more downside in choosing the wrong investors. An investor is very unlikely to make you a successful company by themselves, but it's very possible they can destroy a successful company quite easily, frankly. And so it's very important to select the right investors, not just that believe in your vision, but that you believe in as people, because they're going to be with you for a long time, through good times and bad times. And the question you have to ask is, in those really dark moments, which you will have, are they the call you're very comfortable making?
Yeah. Very good, Raj. Thank you for coming, and we'll keep following your journey. It's inspiring, and we love what you're doing.
Good work.
Bye-bye.